Welcome to The Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine that had the foresight a few months back, doing a special issue on the 30th anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, a wheezing Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Dobre rano vsheti.
That was pretty good. Thank you. Yeah. Was that Ukrainian howdy on my behalf?
Happy Monday.
It was bastardized Czechoslovakian, which is not a language. But, it's okay. Slavs, man. Slavs.
Check it out.
Nope. Yeah, didn't Serbo-Croatian used to be a language?
Although they differentiated by one of them saying, screw it, we're doing Cyrillic. We're totally different now. But they were about as separated as Czech and Slovak, which are close, but not exactly the same. And for a full list of Slavic language history, stay tuned for the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie with Matt Welch talking later. Okay, so we're going to dive into some of the more worrying aspects of America's response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But first, as too many of us have discovered firsthand, your so-called health insurance all too often does not pay for the full amount of medical bills incurred during an emergency, especially when it comes to transportation. Even with comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with super high deductibles and copays for your journey between emergency and hospital. That's where the AirMed Care Network steps in. When you join AirMed Care as a member, if an emergency arises requiring transportation by air, you will not see a bill when flown by an AMCN provider. This peace of mind is available for your entire household beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. More than 100,000 patients use this outstanding service every year. Listeners to the Roundtable can get, along with their membership, a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card. That's right, $85 gets you peace of mind and $50 back. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason, use the offer code REASON, and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, the latest news out of Ukraine as of Monday morning, which is when we taped this podcast, is that the Russian military convoy headed to Kiev appears to have been stalled. The capital and most other cities remain in Ukrainian control. Russians, who have been incurring pretty heavy losses of tanks, aircraft, and soldiers, continued to lob missiles into residential areas and has, in multiple instances, opened fire on civilians attempting to escape. Speaking of which, the refugee count from Ukraine has swollen to more than 1.5 million people, which basically matches the entire run in the 1990s from Yugoslavia in less than 2 weeks. Meanwhile, we are beginning to see Russians leaving their homeland, which has been crippled with economic sanctions, as well as a god-awful crackdown on dissent, including the shuttering of most independent journalism, mass arrests at demonstrations, and 15-year jail sentences threatened for protesters. Today comes news that Vladimir Putin has offered and Volodymyr Zelensky has rejected a ceasefire deal that would have Ukraine give up its contested breakaway regions and to vow official foreign policy neutrality. The American response, which will be the focus of our conversation here today, has so far involved rejecting Zelensky's requests for a no-fly zone out of fear of escalation, while also asserting that NATO will not tolerate even 1 inch of its territory being attacked by Ruskies. Sanctions, both governmental and private sector, remain the biggest tool Washington has been using, with the current discussion focusing on whether to block the import of Russian oil and gas. Catherine, looking at the responses that have either been enacted already or encouraged by Washington or have a realistic chance of happening in the near future, what so far has worried you the most?
So I went down on Sunday to the rally that was in front of the White House. It was sort of a pro-Ukraine rally with unclear demands, which is how rallies be sometimes. And one thing that I was really struck by was that the people at the rally did seem to reflect some of the polling that has gotten talked about in the last week, which is that a lot of Americans, 74% of Americans, support a no-fly zone in Ukraine. And Biden has been super clear that he's not going to do it. I think Rubio was out there this weekend saying it would be a terrible idea. I think that the actual politicians remain and sort of decision makers here remain a pretty solid hell no on that plan. But it is interesting to me that so many Americans do seem to support that approach. And so it makes me a little bit hesitant to rule it out. I mean, I am not generally one to say, oh, well, the generals said X, therefore, when it comes to war, because we've seen where that takes us. But I did learn the term peer adversary this weekend, which I had never heard before, which basically is we do a no-fly zone when we are extremely confident we can push someone around with it and that they will not, in fact, retaliate at a level that we are unwilling to tolerate. Russia is, new term, a peer adversary. And so that is a much riskier and ill-advised move in that case. I will be taking this term into my personal life as well. So there's a little kind of news you can use.
With which members of this podcast?
I refuse to say, but you know who you are.
Are any of us exempt? Yeah.
So basically, I think, though in theory, no-fly zone remains on the list of unlikely to occur events, I am struck not just because I stood in a group of people chanting for it yesterday, but also the polling that does seem to be something people are kind of calling for, and it makes me nervous.
Aren't those polls a result of a misunderstanding on the part of Americans?
People definitely have no idea what a no-fly zone is.
A regulatory declaration, because it sounds like the sort of thing that, you know, that the Department of whatever can just say, oh, we're gonna have a mandate. We're gonna have a no-fly mandate, and you know. That'll probably work. But what it is, it's a commitment to shoot down Russian planes that we will almost certainly either have to act on or then not act on at the very last minute, which is also a bad thing.
Correct. And I do think, you know, the what people are telling pollsters in, you know, an under-explained poll question is different than what was on the signs in Lafayette Park. But there were a lot of signs in Lafayette Park, and those people presumably have a slightly better idea of what's going on. And of course, Zelensky, who has called for it, knows exactly what it means.
The protesters are arguing in favor, those signs are in favor of doing what Zelensky wants the United States to do. And they feel like doing that is the way to support Ukraine, is by giving Ukraine what Ukraine is asking for.
Correct.
Ukraine, of course, is asking for things that are in some ways in Ukraine's interests, at least arguably.
In every way in Ukraine's
and they are,
interest. Yeah.
But that does not necessarily mean that they are in the United States' interest.
I will say there was also another sign at this protest, and I looked at it for like four beats too long. I for sure thought this sign said defund Ukraine. Like defund the police, and it said defend. It said defend. But I thought there was like a weird kind of counter protest happening amidst the defund Ukraine force. It doesn't exist, in case you were wondering.
I remain committed to my longstanding goal of at protests and elsewhere of U.S. out of Nebraska. It's time. It's time that we left. Nick, what is a thing that has you worried?
Generally speaking, the speed with which certainly the media and even I think a lot of people that I talked to who were pretty anti-war a couple of weeks ago, now, you know, presented with a situation where, you know, there's good and evil here in terms of Russia, you know, is an aggressor without, you know, good justification for doing what it did. The people that I've been talking to and the stuff I've been seeing are just people are like, yeah, you know what, the U.S., we've got to make a difference here. We've got to be involved, and we can help make this right. It gets vague after that, but it's almost as if the past 20 years of disastrous military intervention abroad has just kind of vanished in the same way that COVID, you know, seems to have vanished over the past week or so. And that deeply, deeply worries me. But and part of the way that this is starting to play out, and, you know, obvious actual politicians are being more circumspect. They're not saying, oh, we got to get boots in the ground. But you do see people calling for troops, you know, more NATO involvement, more troops in Europe, Biden, for the most part, has been very good on kind of drawing bright lines about this stuff. But there's a bill being introduced in Congress where the U.S. government, and actually it puts the power in the hands of Biden to seize assets of Russian elites, anything that's over $5 million. This is going after yachts, of course, because, you know, that's the leading kind of indicator of, you know, Russian oligarch kleptocracy and whatnot. You know, that's, it should be disturbing to people, the speed and rapidity with which we're, you know, drawing, you know, good versus evil, and America is going to come in on the side of good and in a seamless way, just fix things or help things in a big, big way. And, you know, on the ridiculous side, in the private sector, the International Cat Federation, which, or International Feline Federation, which sanctions cat shows, have banned Russian breeds. Any cat that is bred in Russia is a licensed breed in Russia, and is being shown by somebody, you know, I guess with a thick Eastern European accent, can no longer participate in international cat shows. And the leaders of this group actually said, you know, we cannot stand here and do nothing. And on a part of it, you know, part of it is,
that's
this is
literally what
form
cats
of virtue
do.
Signaling. Yeah, the cats are better than dogs. We can have this podcast any week, but you know, this kind of virtue signaling should be disturbing, partly because it, to the extent that it we reduce cultural exchange. You know, we're not, you know, the Russian people are not going to rise up against Putin. He's not a representative member, you know, he's not a representative leader, but we're going to punish everybody and cut them off, which will then make it easier for Russian propaganda to say, you see, the West really is out to destroy us. I think it's a bad rush that we have, you know, been jumping into of trying to absolutely vilify Russia. In a recent video I put out, you know, I likened it to the turnaround against Germans in World War I. You know, and none of this is to say Russia is a moral country, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, we're acting like it's World War I and we should start shooting dachshunds and, you know, and renaming sauerkraut. I don't know. Well, actually, Stolenica or Stoli,
just say
whatever
Stoli.
The Stoli. Well, Stoli, which is not a Russian vodka brand, has already renamed itself as Stoli because, you know, people are pouring it down the drain and bashing.
Our sexy American girlfriend, Kennedy on Fox Business, had a great interview with the dude who runs Stoli, who's like Australian or New Zealand or one of those sub nations. It's well worth your time to seek out. Suderman, are you accepting everyone's donated Stoli patriotic vodka shipments?
I don't really make vodka cocktails, but sure. You know, if that's what you like, go for it.
That's a someone poked the bear, apparently. What has you worried, Mr. Peter Suderman?
Similarly, I'm concerned about some of the cultural exchange issues, and in particular, the I think you could call it censorship or at least something deplatforming of Russian filmmakers at some film festivals, including the Glasgow Film Festival. And the argument in many of these cases is that these films were made with Russian government funding, and that's true. But that's because in Russia, it's virtually impossible to get a film made without some level of government funding. That's just the system that exists. Many of those filmmakers are critics of Putin. They are liberals. They are not Putin apparatchiks. And yet they are being taken, their work is being taken out of circulation anyway. I think that's worrying. In part, it's because of something we were talking about when Catherine was talking about the protesters, is that the Ukrainian Film Society, I think it's the Ukrainian Academy of Film, has put forth a petition which has something like 8,000 signatures saying that these films need to be taken out of circulation because it creates the illusion that that Russia can participate in Western values. But it's not Russia. It's individual specific filmmakers often making movies that have absolutely nothing to do with the political conflict, with the war in Ukraine right now. And so these filmmakers filmmakers are, you know, it's very difficult to get your work shown and to make a living as a filmmaker anywhere in the world. And film festivals are just a vital part of that. And by taking these people out of circulation, I think that hurts audiences. It makes it worse for them because they can't see the voices that are coming out of Russia that may not be, you know, pro-Putin and that may be quite a bit more liberal. And it hurts filmmaking and the filmmaking community and the individual filmmakers whose work now cannot find an audience and is being basically blacked out because of either in response to the Ukrainian Film Society request or just be out of a general sense of sort of patriotic duty that I think doesn't actually line up and doesn't really make sense in this context, because no one is helped by this. And this is the sort of thing that we need to be thinking about, is whether you are a private actor or whether you are a U.S. senator or whether you are sort of calling for the government to do things or just sort of calling for your own organization to do things. Who are you hurting and who are you helping? And in a lot of cases, I think these sanctions are mostly going to end up hurting the Russian people, and rather than Putin himself or the, you know, the political appointees, the bureaucrats and oligarchs who run Russia. And that's not what the goal should be. The goal should not be to hurt ordinary Russians. The goal should not be to strike out against the Russian people, but instead to punish Putin and punish the war machine and punish the political machine that is waging a horrific and illegitimate war in Ukraine.
You know, if I may, just to pick up on something Peter was talking about, it goes back to a different kind of virtue signaling that was happening in America. Remember when all sorts of, you know, leagues and other groups suspended any interaction with Georgia? Because American Georgia, because of its voting rights laws. It's interesting, you know, Georgia has about the most robust film subsidy program in America. And I didn't hear anybody say, you know what, you shouldn't watch Archer on FX because it gets a subsidy from Georgia, et cetera. Or Tyler Perry, you know, whose movie I promoted, Medea Homecoming, I think last week. It's good. Like, should he have been punished because Georgia supposedly, you know, created laws that would disenfranchise black people? No. I mean, like, this is a good moment to start talking about, you know, virtue signaling through kind of symbolic economic boycotts and things like that. And along Peter's line, figuring out what actually helps to improve a situation and what, you know, what is just feel-good bullshit that we should be attacking.
I mean, similarly, you have big movie studios pulling their films out of Russia and saying, we're not going to release them, or at least we're not going to release them right now. So that's Disney, which hilariously is declining to release their film Turning Red. That's literally the name of the movie that they are not going to be releasing, at least not yet, in Russia. And Warner Brothers did not release The Batman, which was the big movie this weekend.
Yeah. And I've got to say right there, that's helping Putin. As somebody who spent what was technically only 3 hours, but seemed
the
like about 15
weekend,
watching Batman
yes.
this weekend. You know, that's
I will say, though, it's one thing for an American company to pull their work out. They control that. That's their property. They can decide whether or not, you know, and look, it's not that film festivals don't have any rights to decide what gets played and what doesn't. But I think it's a little bit different. It's also probably the case that Disney and Warner Brothers and big American film studios are deciding not to release their films in Russia right now because there's no way for them to get the money out of Russia, given that the banking system is so hosed. And so this is an almost entirely symbolic move that's just about them taking, you know, sort of wanting to be seen taking the right side here, since they're not going to make any money anyway.
There's also a situation on the ground, which unfortunately, because of its very nature, it's hard to get super reliable information on. But there have been some harsh restrictions put on what Russian citizens can and can't say about what is happening in Ukraine right now that are truly astonishing if what, you know, what's on Twitter and what's in the news is true, including that you can't say the word war about what's happening there. And, you know, there are videos, again, don't speak Russian, don't trust anything on Twitter, but like there are videos of uniformed Russians stopping people who are walking down the streets and just demanding to see their phones to see if they are texting about the war. Like that is covered within these misinformation laws. First of all, we can talk about how that makes us feel about misinformation laws, which is really bad. But also that one can easily imagine a scenario where going to an American movie in Moscow right now might not be something people would be willing to do for a variety of reasons.
So along those lines, Russia currently says that it is banning Facebook in Russia. Now, I don't know how true that is, and there may be some access through VPNs or other measures. It may be easy to get a workaround. I have no idea. But what does that tell you is that Russia is actually waging a fairly serious disinformation campaign in its inside its own country against its own citizens, and they view Facebook as a tool for routing around that. And when figures who have political control are trying to ban the public from getting to places where they can communicate with each other and communicate with the outside world, that's a bad thing.
I would add to the rubric or the test of, you know, who is this helping and hurting when you're contemplating any given action privately. I would also add, especially from the policy point of view, does this degrade our own so-called values? I think when you're degrading property rights in the name of going after oligarchs, that ain't helping nobody. If you're degrading free speech rights, if you're actively trying to get people to kick RT, the Russian television arm that I used to go on sometimes way back when, from the airwaves here, I mean, it doesn't look very good. CNN, the Reliable Sources newsletter, had a headline 3 or 4 days ago, like, you know, Russia cracks down on media, RT banned from American, or, you know, RT finally gotten rid of locally, without really sort of grappling with the dissonance.
RT being removed from cable is at least a little different, since it wasn't by government order.
Right. But to the extent which that is even a private reflex, like, what we need to do is to ban propaganda. And that's, you know, that's coming from the White House about COVID and a bunch of other things as well. We need to actively combat misinformation and propaganda. That shows a shocking and dispiriting lack of faith in the ability of consumers to kind of judge for themselves. And I, for one, I want to be able to see what their propaganda looks like. I think that's useful information. It's just the same thing as, like, you know, when there was attempts in 2015 after the terrorist attack in Riverside, California, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, who were then campaigning for president, said, you know, we need to shut down parts of Facebook. No, dude, we want to be able
just
to see
the,
what they're...
the terrorist parts, man.
Just the terrorist parts.
You know, the ones they all carry that. That's one of the... That's usually the first or second tag that they put on
knowing
posts. So it's
knowing
easy to
what
do.
Russians know is also, I think, pretty important, given that an awful lot of people are currently in the business of evaluating the moral culpability of ordinary Russians and what's going on. You know, we're seeing a bunch of, you know, if you haven't left Russia by now, you're part of the problem, or that, you know, it's fine if ordinary Russians suffer because... and you know me, I have long said that living in a territory is not the same thing as somehow having magically consented to be a part of whatever the state that rules that territory does. I also think that, you know, it's been actually astonishing to see even the amount of pushback that has happened in Russia. I mean, there have been anti-war protests in Russia, which is like huge.
We should be celebrating that and connecting with those people.
But those things are not morally mandatory. Those things are praiseworthy. But the idea that, you know, exceptional acts of civil disobedience and bravery are the bare minimum is something that, like, Americans can say from the gloriously free nation that we live in, and is just an absolutely wild and insane thing to imply about, like, regular Russian citizens.
I would add,
if I may, just, you know, one of the great books of kind of libertarian American history or historiography.
Stoli.
I'm having trouble.
Stoliography.
American Stoliography is The Decline of American Liberalism by Arthur E. Kirch, who is it's a classical liberal reading of American history from the colonial period through the 50s. He reprinted it in the late 60s. But he talked about when he got to talking about the garrison state during the Cold War, he said one of the harsh realities of it was, in order to fight the Soviet Union, we became more like the Soviet Union, where the individual had to be subjugated to the collective. And you hear echoes of this in, you know, the Agamben type fixation on the state of exception, where in order to maintain liberal orders, you have to suspend all of the laws and all of the restrictions on government that make it a liberal order in order to protect it, in order to keep it. And you know, this is a very mild version of that. But Matt, to your point, the more that we start acting like Russia and banning things, you know, by law and then also by custom and trying to force a conformity into things, it's like, you know, it's not Russia doesn't win because of that. Ukraine isn't helped. Russia doesn't win, but America suffers. And we really, you know, we need to break free of a Cold War mentality that has influenced not just our foreign policy detrimentally up until the current moment, but also our kind of cultural life. And, you know, this should be a moment where we draw sharp distinctions between governments and societies. And we also do everything we can to help Ukraine as well as help Russians, you know, live a life, something approaching.
Isn't the, to beat your enemy, you have to understand them and become them, the lesson of Ender's Game?
I was going to say, or Batman, every fucking Batman movie at some point. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah, we're, you know, now it's the Riddler. Right, that we're all like the Riddler. I would
speak for yourself,
like Gillespie. But
I just think
no. But this is like it's always like, hey, Batman. You know, you and I were the same thing. I just happen to kill a lot.
I just think we need a gritty reboot of Batman. Finally,
it's a great idea.
You know, I'm thinking maybe we need a gritless reboot just of Batman. Just, you know, because like if the Archie comics is going
smooth
dark,
as
Batman
a baby's
should
bottom.
Go light.
That's what we need now.
yeah, go back to Adam West.
Before you know? We leave the topic, there's freshish news that fills me with loathing, which is that President Joe Biden is talking about maybe paying a state visit to Saudi Arabia. Smooth relations, repair relations with
it's just
that
really
very
out here heightening those contradictions, huh? He's just doing it.
He is amenitizing the eschaton in a way that we don't expect him to.
And part of the reason for that is to encourage them to pump out more oil, and maybe we can reduce the prices, which is, allows for more of sanctions to be put on Russian oil import. My God, dude. No. This is one of the most authoritarian, sickly, awful, murderous regimes on the planet, and the whole one of the biggest sins of America during the Cold War period and after the Cold War period is to say, well, because that oil supply is so important and Western Europe in particular has some problems importing enough energy, we are going to guarantee stability in the region and have a bunch of client states and all this garbage. No, 1,000 times no. And 1,000 times, the United States should have learned by now, produce your own damn energy. Don't put artificial shackles on that. And Western Europe, it's taken them a good 60 or 70 years to come to that belated realization. And let's hope to see them crank up nukes as soon as possible.
What's also interesting, Matt, is that in Europe, what you're seeing, and this is a good thing, you are seeing Germany, France, Italy, and other larger powers actually stepping up and doing things in their continent, which is good. You know, the idea, like if America, you were always worried, if America recedes, chaos will happen. In fact, what we're seeing in Europe and in the EU is them actually stepping up to deal with a problem which is fundamental to their security and their stability, not America's. In the Middle East, the Abraham Accords, and you know, Donald Trump doesn't get enough credit for this, but both through the Abraham Accords, but also the U.S. leaving. And I heard somebody talking about this at the Israeli consulate over the last summer. But when America left the Middle East, actually, and plus the Abraham Accords, what you are starting to see are the countries that are actually there dealing with each other in better ways to kind of cordon off things like Russia's influence in Syria and Syria's and Iranian influence. And you're getting Israel, the Sauds, the UAE, et cetera, actually taking responsibility for their region and coming up with better answers that are actually sustainable, because they don't depend on the U.S. parachuting in, making a lot of to do and then kind of leaving or not following through on our principles.
I would even suggest that this is a golden opportunity for the U.S. to encourage actively, out loud, its European allies to actually be the ones responsible for the security of Europe. Not only get the U.S. out of Nebraska, but also to de-Americanize NATO. Come on, it's time. All right, we're going to extend the Russian conversation a little bit with our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia? You can do something about that today. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable to receive instant, confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what a lot of people need right now, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. Other financial aid is also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out immediately. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to send us your brief yet incisive email queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from our old pal Norm. It's a great Twitter follow at Timberati, T-I-M-B-E-R-A-T-I. He writes in part, this is extending some of our previous conversation. The Cork Opera House canceled an upcoming performance of Swan Lake by the Royal Moscow Ballet. FIFA, that's some kind of soccer thing, has said that Russia will not be allowed to compete in the World Cup, and the Eurovision Song Contest announced Russia will not participate in the 2022 show. The Economist magazine tweeted that, quote, the world must be willing to bleed Vladimir Putin's regime of the resources that enable him to wage war and abuse his own people, even if that imposes costs on Western economies, end quote. I suspect, Norm says, or continues, that sanctions such as the one The Economist calls for will hurt the most vulnerable in Russia's population. I think there is something of a consensus that Putin believes that Russia ought to be an imperialist nation, and he craves to be a large player on the world stage such that Russia is respected as a world-class power. So the question is it possible that the snubbing of Russian performances will have no effect on Putin? Catherine, what say you?
So I think that the very simple idea behind this snubbing, as you say, is that it will somehow dissuade Putin from his murderous territorial aggression. I think that's frankly a little bit tenuous. I think, you know, it's quite right to say that many of these sanctions, you know, Putin has a lot of padding. Putin has a lot of insurance. He is going to be fine, even as regular Russians starve. But I actually think some of the Cold War stories that really stick with me are the stories of Russians or people from, you know, people from various kind of, chess associations, your gymnasts, your diplomats, your whatever, being in the United States and just seeing some detail that made them realize that the place they lived was not only unfree, but also unsustainable. And that, you know, you heard that story over and over. And admittedly, the Cold War was a long haul. But I really think every opportunity we have to have prominent people from Russia, even the owners of prominent Russian cats, if you will, you know, to be in the outside world, to see what other people believe and know about their country, to give them the opportunity to defect, which obviously we should be doing super extensively. Every refugee, including Russians, should be welcome on our shores. And, you know, so I think the theory is not totally unsound. Just squeeze Russia until they break. but the practice is, I think, not terribly effective and could be more targeted, right? Like, we already have, these sanctions are like super, super, super elaborately crafted. We've listed each type of caviar and which ones the importation is forbidden and which ones it's allowed. We can surely be smarter about this. And I think that cultural exchange is something that should broadly be exempted, even as we, you know, I'm quite cheerful about very, very narrowly targeted sanctions that punish, you know, Putin and his inner circle, as well as, you know, sanctions that disable military capabilities. But I think that the kind of excessive cultural aspects of this do start to very, very immediately raise the question of who is actually going to suffer. And it's not Putin.
Suderman, do you think that there's a prestige vulnerability?
I just like the idea that if the world must be willing to bleed Vladimir Putin's regime of the resources that enabled him to wage war, one of them is the Eurovision Song Contest.
I mean, people take that thing weirdly seriously.
Yeah.
Come on. There's that footage of him singing Blueberry Hill. I mean, he wants to be a rock star.
Right. So obviously this is going to work. No, my actual worry is that this is going to be counterproductive, not just that it's going to have no effect, because the goal here is to remove Russia and Russia's status from the world. And in some sense, the goal is to belittle Russia, to say, nay, 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 boo, boo, you can't be in our club anymore. Right?
Because, I'm sorry, because there's, what should we say?
Nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
Thank you.
You can't be in our club anymore.
Is that
nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
No club for you. In Russia, club exclude you. Right? No, and it's...
Yeah.
And it's just a...
Yeah, why
and
so it's burning just, Yakov Smirnoff right.
And so it's
effigy,
just a status play that is entirely... This has no effect on the Russian military or its ability to wage war. This doesn't even really have a huge effect on Russia's economy, at least the individual interventions, right? I mean, the bank sanctions have a huge effect, but any particular performance is not going to have a meaningful effect on Russia's economy and unlikely to even have a significant effect on any particular famous person or rich person or oligarch who is connected to Putin enough to actually put pressure on him. But what this is going to do is it's going to send a signal to Putin that that the Western world thinks they're above him, that they think that he's little and weak and worthless, and that that he doesn't really matter. And so it's not like saying to a bully, you can't bully people. It's like saying to a bully, you can't bully people, and also we're going to make you walk around with your thumb in your mouth and your pants down so that everybody can laugh at you, right? Like, it's there's a kind of...
Said oddly
no,
specific.
But you're right.
There's a kind of, emotional cruelty intended here that I don't think is appropriate, and I think could well backfire if Putin decides to take this as, well, you know what? You've told me I don't have any choice. I don't have any power. I am going to display the power that I do have to you, and the one power that he is going to retain is the power to wage nuclear war. And I'm just not going to get over that, because it's so significant and such a huge risk, even if it is a small one, that at no point should you ever be baiting somebody like Putin and you know, running around saying, look, you're a dimwit, you're a doofus, you have no standing on the international stage. We're going to, in addition to trying to stop you from killing innocents, what we're also going to do is we're going to try to embarrass you. And I just think that that's a really bad way of going about this.
Okay, counterpoint though. What if by doing all of these sanctions and all of these bans, including the private one, we're actually doing kind of the opposite, right? Like, to treat someone as a mortal enemy is to respect them, right? Like, it's to acknowledge that they hold this power, which, I mean, I'm just thinking, I'm in my peer adversary mindset here. I'm just thinking about this concept some more, but like, I think, you know, arguably the entire world losing its shit over this, and especially Russia's historical adversary, the United States, losing its shit in this very demonstrative way is what Putin wants. Now, that still isn't an argument for doing it. I'm not actually saying this is a good plan, but I actually, my instinct on this is not that all of these kind of cultural sanctions in particular are an act of disdain nearly so much as that they are an act of respect.
Look, I think you can overstate all of this. I think you can overstate all of this. And the most likely outcome here is that there's not really a whole lot of effect either way. The Eurovision Song Contest is not going to lead to nuclear war or prevent it.
Why would you say that out loud? Now it's going to happen. You jinxed us, Suderman.
But to kind of extend Catherine's point a little bit, it's complicated. It's not the whole world. India and China are not joining the Western crusade of good versus evil and things like that. So it's worth thinking about that. And I do think in the EU and certainly in America, this is all happening in the context. I think it needs to be looked at in the context of the past 20 years of disastrous interventions in the Middle East, which were fundamentally American interventions, but there was also a lot of EU support and whatnot. You know, France had soldiers in Afghanistan for a long period of time, even if they chose not to invade Iraq with us and whatnot. And I think this is kind of a snapback to the idea of, like, we really have kind of fucked stuff up, including refugee operations and things like that coming out of that. And now we are going to act with a certain kind of moral certitude. The other thing that all of this does is, like, it doesn't, you know, what can we actually be doing to help people in Ukraine? What can we be doing to de-escalate the situation, which might include giving, which will certainly include giving, you know, Putin what is now universally called an off-ramp that will be morally disgusting and disturbing, you know, to all of us, but it might actually get him to stop invading Ukraine, killing people there, shelling, and withdraw to something like the original border or a situation that is at least, you know, phenomenally better than what we're in now. So we're, you know, among everything else, we're not even kind of focusing on the things that we might actually be doing to bring more peace to the world.
Let's transition here to a quick assessment of the thing that most of you have probably already forgotten about, but it was President Joe Biden gave a State of the Union address, the annual message that the president doesn't have to actually give on primetime television. You can hand it in writing, as they did for more than a century, but that's not how things work anymore. They seem to deteriorate slowly over the years in quality and importance. Yet, I think these speeches still are kind of an interesting snapshot of an administration's priorities, self-conceptions, and how it approaches its work. So since we are kind of skeptics of the work of the executive branch of the United States government, or at least the way that it's manifested, including in these kinds of speeches, I'd like to hear each of us talk briefly, perhaps, about what you found tellingly unbueno about last week's State of the Union. Suderman, you want to lead off?
The thing that stuck out to me was how much Biden was just repeating himself. So on the campaign trail, he wanted a whole bunch of spending on social spending, healthcare, climate, that sort of the thing. And this was before the pandemic. And then the pandemic hit, and he was like, "Well, you know what we need is a whole bunch of domestic policy spending on healthcare and social programs and climate to fight the pandemic." And then he was elected president, and the pandemic has done what it's done. And he keeps saying this, and he got some of that passed up front, but kept pushing it, right? And then it turned out that it was going to be hard to get that stuff passed because Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are somewhat skeptical of some of this. And what Joe Manchin in particular has said is, "Well, you know, I'm really worried about inflation and I'm really worried about the deficit." And so Biden's plan now is to do exactly the same thing he's been calling for the entire time, but say that it will fight inflation and cut the deficit. And yet, he has, in his State of the Union, he announced exactly nothing serious to reduce the deficit. The only new plan that he had in there was an initiative to fight waste, fraud, and abuse, which is what you say when you want to look like you're about to cut government spending, or like you're going to be smarter about the size of government and the deficit, and you actually don't want to do anything different at all. He also bragged about having cut the deficit in half after the giant pileup of deficit spending in 2020 and 2021. I mean, Biden didn't do anything. If we'd actually gotten his agenda passed, it probably would have been larger here. It's still well over $1 trillion, and it's just completely unserious. And it shows how Biden has completely failed to adapt to circumstances. His agenda has remained totally static from pre-pandemic when he was still in, still running against Bernie Sanders, to the point at which he won the nomination and we were in a pandemic situation. He was running against Donald Trump, and then the point when he was finally in the office and then running into conflict with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And it's just a laundry list. It's just a long list of non-prioritized Democratic spending priorities that existed for years before Joe Biden even had the nomination. And he's just not at all willing to adapt or change in any way. And I think the State of the Union just showed kind of how static and how played out the Biden presidency is.
Catherine?
I will just briefly mention the thing that I tweeted about during the State of the Union that went semi-viral. Joe Biden, in his laundry list part of the speech, which is always the worst part, said, by the way, childcare is too expensive and people should only pay an arbitrary percentage of their income, which I just made up, which isn't real. And he mentioned that women left the workforce during the pandemic because they couldn't afford childcare. And I just tweeted, or maybe it was because their children were out of school for an entire year. And let me tell you, the gaslighting in my freaking mentions, the number of people in there being like, actually, schools weren't always closed for like a whole year. Like, it was like, you jerk faces. You know exactly what I mean. And the technical number of months that the schools were closed, my eldest daughter was in fact out of school for a full year. But even if they were out of school for 6 months, the problem is not a extensive set of regulations setting prices for childcare. The problem is that we should not add to that totally broken system that was closed for ages and ages another, you know, several years of our children's lives. What the hell? What a terrible proposal. And the idea that people are really out here retconning what happened with kids during the pandemic is wild.
The Biden administration's plan to subsidize childcare also is quite likely to make childcare much more expensive and harder to find, especially for families in the, let's say, in the comfortable but not quite comfortable middle class zone of like low six-figure earnings.
Right. I mean, he flat out just asserted all of these will lower costs about both the childcare subsidy and the universal pre-K proposals, and that is untrue.
Yeah. And to the point where even a bunch of lefty progressive types have looked at the plan and said, this is going to make it either very difficult to get care or very expensive or both. And so all of these professional couples who are upset about the cost of childcare are going to see this plan in action if it ever passes and be really, really upset.
Oh, also a lot of people were in my mentions saying, well, yeah, but it's better if the women stay home because that's how God intended it. So just a little bonus for you there.
U.S. and
that's an interesting idea that the, you know, religious conservatives will start going towards Biden.
Yeah, like the COVID closure.
Supporting family
values. I mean, I've
seen
that. Like that hot take has been out there smoldering for a while. The pandemic was good because it reminded American families that the women should be home taking care of the children is for sure a thing that some people believe.
Nick?
I was buoyed, Matt, by Biden's insistence that we have not just a infrastructure week or month, but a decade, an infrastructure decade, which is kind of a signal that he's not going to get anything done, I think.
And also, but, yeah, like we're going to, yeah, I'm sure that we're going to come back around, you know, as soon as next year, say, you know, that what we really need now is infrastructure. Like after we've spent all the trillions on infrastructure and nothing got built, like, oh, at this time, you know, these crumbling roads and bridges, got to get them.
Well, it's going to be the Trump strategy
for 25
of
years.
Like campaigning on it forever and promising to do it forever and not doing it because actually there's already plenty of money sloshing around and nothing to do with it. And anyway, the money can't get to the broken things.
It's also, yeah, and it's amazing too, because I don't even want to talk about this anymore, but like infrastructure spending never does something like, you know what? We're going to build five new tunnels and bridges between New Jersey and New York. Or in California, we're going to expand highway capacity. It's never even promised that like any of this shit is going to do anything. Like, we'll replace old bridges with bridges that look exactly the same.
or, you know, but are a little bit sleeker. Like, there's not even a vision, at least with the interstate highway system. You know, there was a vision to do something new and different, as opposed to, and this was a big part of TARP, you know, we're going to repave roads and thereby jumpstart the economy. It's not like we're actually going to do something that would materially change how shitty, you know, traffic congestion is, or air traffic congestion is in any
Biden does have a vision. It's to pay union guys prevailing wages to do stuff.
It's true.
Yeah.
Three words for you, Gillespie. Recovery through retrofit. Never forget. Never, ever forget. My thing that I hated the most in the State of the Union address, besides my life, was the way after the initial 10 minutes, 12 minutes talking about Ukraine, then very quickly transitioning to, and, you know, talk, and based on the notion that, hey, look, you know, you guys were poo-pooing the international order, but look at us, we're all more unified than ever, blah, 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 blah. And then transitioning to, and that's why we have to buy everything America first. There is an absolute dissonance between those two things. It was understood after the end of World War II, president after president, didn't matter which party, understood that the systematic reduction of tariffs, the systematic repudiation of buy America first stuff, was a great way to help what was then known as the free world get on its own two feet. I remember Western Europe was devastated back then. So we encouraged them to create a common market so that they can get stronger and start looking after themselves. Didn't totally fully work out, of course, parts of that, but they did get richer a lot faster. And so did we. And to, in the same breath, in the same speech, sort of talk about the international order and then work against it actively. I gave a whole speech on Friday, just like, and this is my Buy America agenda. It's a terrible agenda. It's going to impoverish us, make us spend more money, and it's going to make it harder for, you know, your good guys out there to get rich themselves and to eradicate poverty.
It's but terrible. It's a plan to fight inflation, right?
It will.
That's what it's going to do.
Once definitely. And for
all, I just like the idea that on the one hand, we're saying that by exclusively purchasing things domestically and cutting yourself off from global trade would be good for America. And yet that is exactly what we are doing to Russia to punish
yeah.
it. I mean, if Biden's plan for buying domestically is great for the economy, then the Russian economy should be booming here.
Booming. Rubles for all
but,
the
you know,
stolies.
It is true. That never, you know, like America Firsters, economic America Firsters never talk about getting rid of exports. Yeah, they've always, you know, we just want to be in a position where we, you know, only buy American, but the world also is forced or has to or ultimately buys American.
Hey, man, it worked for Ceausescu in the 80s, as Catherine can tell you. So it can work for us.
No, that's true.
In the new yeah. 20s. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, cultural consumptions. Catherine, what did you consume?
I consumed the collection of short stories by Ralph Ellison, Flying Home. They revealed to me that while Invisible Man is one of the best books ever written, maybe everything else Ralph Ellison wrote was not super, super great. So that was an interesting sort of study in watching a writer become himself. But the titular story, Flying Home, is actually very good. It's about a black pilot who crashes in a field, and it has this very complicated and interesting structure. It was named after and potentially inspired by one of the best songs ever to come out of the Benny Goodman Orchestra, also called Flying Home. So if you want to do a little short story and listening exercise, I think that the two pair kind of interestingly, and it's a fun little historical project. The song Flying Home was supposedly written because one of the members of the Benny Goodman Orchestra was flying for the first time and was extremely nervous about getting on a plane. And this was basically the ditty that he nervously whistled. So just like a bunch of good backstory, even if most of the stories in this collection do not rise to the level of Invisible Man. I do recommend Flying Home, both the song and the short story.
Dr. Gillespie?
I read Love in the Time of Contagion, a diagnosis by Laura Kipnis, who's just a fantastic essayist who both you, Matt, and I have interviewed in the past about her previous book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Kipnis is a left-leaning, left-wing, she calls herself at some point a lapsed Marxist feminist, who writes frankly and wonderfully about sexuality and gender. And this time it's the intersection of COVID and lockdowns and the Me Too movement, as well as the rise of a kind of millennial ambisexual kind of character that is playing out in social media. Love in the Time of Contagion is just a fantastic collection of essays about, you know, kind of contemporary sexual and social mores, which highly, highly recommend.
Peter.
Like many, many of you in listening, like many listeners, I suspect, I saw The Batman, which is a reboot of the Batman franchise. This is, I've been watching Batman movies since 1989 now, and like this is, I don't remember exactly how many of them there have been. Eight standalone Batman films, plus those Affleck movies, which are they really Batman films? I had mixed feelings about it. It is really gloriously moody and steeped in kind of interesting cinematic atmospherics. It's too long, I think, at 3 hours long, even though it's reasonably well paced. It's it kind of pulls a lot from David Fincher, especially his movies Seven and Zodiac. And I'm a big, big David Fincher fan. So in theory, this should be a movie for me. But it felt in a weird way a little bit uncomfortable with its own hero. So previous movies have often, as Nick already said, contrasted Batman with his villain characters and sort of suggested, oh, look, there's ways in which they're the same. But they've always done that in order to affirm Batman's difference and his essential goodness, right? In the end, Batman is the good guy and the Joker is the bad guy. And this one pulls the same trick with Paul Dano's Riddler character, except that it seems to sort of waffle on the question of whether Batman is actually good in the end. I mean, and it sort of suggests, look, if you think about it, he's a misguided billionaire vigilante who thinks he can save his city through like creepy rubber suit cosplay. Like how, you know, sort of self-absorbed is that, right? I mean, and so it's sort of an interesting film in that it wrestles with the idea of the Batman and doesn't seem super comfortable with it. I don't think it totally works. I think it's structurally just a little bit messy. And you know, in part, that's why it's so long, is the movie has several endings. But it's just sort of, it's conceptually fascinating to see this gigantic Hollywood production about one of maybe the single most popular fictional character on the planet right now. And the movie is about how maybe that character is actually bad because he's a white guy billionaire who's just acting out his own fantasies rather than trying to save the city through the normal way, you know, politics.
If I may add a couple of points to that. One, this movie has the potential to do for Duct Tape what E.T. did for Reese's Pieces. Oh. The way Duct Tape gets used, and when you see it, you will know exactly what I mean. But Duct Tape is like in every major scene of this. So, you know, it's got that going for it. As an Italian American, I was happy to see Italian American gangsters playing a major role in this movie. We're kind of getting left behind by the march of history. So it's nice to be represented in that sense. And then more substance.
I mean, John Turturro is always great. He's fantastic. I'm just happy to see John Turturro in anything.
I want him to keep working. Yeah. Even after he's dead. But, you know, to your point, Peter, I think part of the problem, when you compare it to something like Zodiac, you know, movies are obviously fictional, they're made up, they're not about real things, but Zodiac is tied to the real world.
The Batman movies are different, though.
Well, what I'm going to say is the terror in Zodiac in particular, and even to a degree with Seven, you know, about serial killers, they live in, you know, they exist on some level and we can refract something meaningful. I think what this Batman movie, again, too long, kind of absorbing, kind of interesting, but it's like, who fucking cares at this point? These are comic book characters, and it just doesn't tie in directly enough to reality in a way to be interesting, especially when it leaves behind the more fantastical elements of going into space or comedy or something like that. And I say this as somebody who spent thousands of dollars when I didn't have it reading comic books and waiting and hoping for comic book movies. They're
but
just
don't
soulless.
You feel like this movie actually was trying to tie Batman into real world fears? So that in this version, Gotham is surrounded by water that is held at bay by a seawall, right? There's sort of an invocation of global warming.
But
there's a young black mayor who is, you know, mayoral candidate who is trying to reform
Gotham,
the city's politics.
Gotham more than ever.
The final sequence, the third act, really sort of seems to gesture at January 6th type fears. And I'm not saying I thought that all of this worked.
No, I agree.
But I actually do think that in part of what didn't work was the effort to tie it to real
world.
What
I was going to say is then do fucking movies about that. This is like, it's similar to Don't Look Up, where it's like, if you want to do a movie about the fact that nobody gives a shit, you think nobody gives a shit about climate change, do that movie instead of a half-assed parody that simply insults everybody who doesn't agree with you already. I mean, let's see a movie about whatever January 6th is in the mind of a filmmaker and come up with that. I'm just kind of tired of filmmakers who want to be serious and portentous and tied into reality, but then refuse to actually engage what's going on in the world and instead play it through, you know, cartoon characters.
I watched, and I can't recommend this highly enough, especially of people who are exactly my age. So on this podcast, that means me. I rewatched, certainly for the first time in, I don't know, 27 years.
Wait, can you milk this? Because the looks on all of our faces on the Skype call we use are kind of...
Thank God.
This is more suspenseful than the Batman.
Holy cow.
It's more suspenseful than we'll cut off my insult. The War Games, people, it's so good. It is absolutely preposterous. The 1983 movie about going down to DEFCON 2, a charming hacker played by an impish Matthew Broderick, and I'm still in love with Ali Sheedy, obviously, all these years later. It is so ridiculous and great and wonderful to watch right now.
Come on, that's a Dabney Coleman movie.
They're all Dabney.
Dabney Coleman. Burnt out memories of my
It's mind. Like incredibly technophobic. You know, we've yielded to the computers when we should be keeping a human element. I felt the spirit of James Polis coming through at that moment, finally. but like the getting back to the absolute fingers on chalkboard tension of prime Cold War era was really a fun ride to go back, and a kind of a vision of something that we will never recapture, like the totality of that feeling, even in a ridiculous movie. Was something that, like, even now when Suderman's getting very upset about the nuclear war, the 80s were just a different planet, and it's really fun
to
revisit.
Did you watch that with your kids?
Sadly, I did.
How did they respond?
So the 7-year-old, which, was kind of like dicey, like, hey, you want to see the nuclear war movie? She loved it. Sadly, the 13-year-old was having a unrelated fit, and so refused to engage with it and walked out after about 2 minutes after looking at her phone.
I think she's just she's taking a stand against Matthew Broderick.
Batham movie, because he's the director, and he also directed one of my childhood favorites from the 80s, Short Circuit, a movie about a war robot that refuses to go to war, right? And also, the same year as he did War Games, did Blue Thunder, a very early movie about the militarization of police and why we shouldn't spend a lot of money giving the police like really fancy attack helicopters.
Peter, the only way to win is not to play.
That's the lesson of this podcast.
Note that I haven't spoken in minutes.
Why are the? Yeah, why did you bring that up now? We could have. Matt, I do think the bloom now in the OK Boomer universe, the bloom is off the idea that any young person is going to be called in to save us from nuclear annihilation.
Oh, God. Oh, God, yeah.
Do you mean like was... that this was going to be like a young adult dystopia situation or?
No, no. This is like Matthew Broderick is just like he's the best missile command player in a video game. So like,
I've moved on. I'm just like pure Hunger Games
up in here.
All of
these Cold War Brezhnev level warmongers have to come to him to bail America.
I think this is what the next Batman movie is going to be about.
I would like that. Again, a gritless Batman is the Batman we need. He's the hero we deserve.
Fun fact about War Games, which, John Badham directed it, although he was brought in as a replacement of Martin Brest. But that the original screenplay was
of Midnight Run fame.
Beverly Hills Cop. The original screenplay was it was based on Stephen Hawking. Like the character, the old scientist was supposed to be Stephen Hawking. And he was supposed to be played by John Lennon, who apparently had preliminarily agreed be in War Games. Absolutely. I don't know where the divergence happened. But that's all the timelines we have time for. What? Thanks for listening. Look at all of our stuff and also listen to it maybe too at reason.com/podcasts. Hashtag Stoli. That includes the Reason interview with Dr. Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum series with Dr. Gene Epstein.
Masters. He never finished a PhD. Gene Epstein, to his eternal shame, as far as I'm concerned.
He's a doctor of dance.
And of, he's got a PhD in heartbreak, but.
What's happening?
I don't know. Make it stop. If you like this and want more of it, I don't know what to say to you, but go to reason.com/donate. What the hell? Give us money. Encourage this behavior. That's it. We'll see you.
If you give us enough money, we'll be like a mariachi band or a strolling violinist. We will go away. You can buy us out if you hit the right amount.
Amen. Goodbye.